Today's program features Leonard Peikoff. Mr. Peikoff will be reading a speech written by philosopher and novelist Ayn Rand. Ms. Rand wrote this speech just before her death this last winter. The moderator will be Deke Russell, film coordinator at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Here is Mr. Russell now to introduce the speaker.
I'm sorry to report to you all a fact which I think you all well know, which is that our announced speaker for the evening, Miss Ayn Rand, died some weeks ago. I've been in quite a serious quandary about saying something about that this evening, because she was a great and glorious friend of the Ford Hall Forum. She appeared more often on our stage at our lectern than any other speaker, and commanded the respect and the interest and what we always at the Forum so deeply admire, the debate of her audiences with vigor and with an annual appearance. My quandary really is that knowing something of her thought, I have some sense that it would be an offense to her and to her views and perhaps to most of those of you to try at too great length to memorialize her or to remember her in the wrong way. From my point of view and my perspective in my life, with the effect that standing on this stage with her has had on me, it is nonetheless the thing that I want to do most. And I thought that rather than make a long speech, as we have a good speech forthcoming shortly, I would just leave you with the sense that this has been a quandary, that she has been on my mind these last few weeks, constantly, as she has for all of us in the Forum. And that in fact, in some very special ways, which I think are to become clear in a few moments, she is in fact here with us tonight. She is here, however, in the presence and through the arrangement that she made with Dr. Leonard Peikoff. Dr. Peikoff was Miss Rand's associate for over 30 years, an associate editor of The Objectivist, a contributing editor of the Ayn Rand Letter, a professor of philosophy who has taught at Hunter College, University of Denver, New York University, and the Polytechnic Institute of Brooklyn. He is the author of the book, The Ominous Parallels, The End of Freedom in America. We're very pleased to have Dr. Peikoff here with us this evening, in particular as his appearance was arranged by Miss Rand herself before she died. And what he has to say to you in the opening part of tonight's meeting are her words. Dr. Peikoff.
Thank you, Mr. Russell. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You know that I am here as a substitute for Ayn Rand. In early February, it became apparent that even assuming the best possible outcome, Miss Rand would not be well enough to travel by April. And she asked me then in the hospital to deliver her Ford Hall talk. At that time, we were thinking of a possible telephone hookup to New York so that she could participate in the question period herself, hopefully while convalescing from her illness. Tragically, it did not happen that way. I'll have to interject and say that this is a difficult evening for me. I hope you'll bear with me if I am occasionally unavoidably emotional. I know that many of you have come this evening as a kind of memorial to Ayn Rand, that you want to reaffirm your support of her and her philosophy, and that that is what is behind your response when I came on stage. Let me say that I share your feeling completely. Ayn Rand was an irreplaceable value. I have no words now to describe it, although I will have whole books on the subject in time. And in the question period, if you wish, I will share with you my impressions of her last weeks. But that is not our purpose now. I want to say at this point only that she was a woman who changed the course of history. She changed the lives of many people in this hall, including my own. And to many of us, no action is more important than carrying on her legacy to the future. If we fail at this task, then I think there will be no future for us or for mankind, not for a very long time to come. But we do not have to fail at it. Objectivists can succeed in spreading objectivism. They should do this, of course, out of intellectual conviction and for their own selfish purposes. But such action would also have a side consequence. It would serve as a memorial or tribute to Ayn Rand, the only kind of memorial she would have wanted, a philosophical one. If we work together in this cause, I think that there is still time. Despite everything that we have against us, we can see to it that Ayn Rand's ideas do save the world. Before turning to Ms. Rand's speech, I want to make a preliminary remark on another subject. Ayn Rand was not an admirer of tradition, but she did establish some traditions of her own. And one of them was her annual springtime speech at the Ford Hall Forum. Miss Rand was thoroughly aware, as you know, of the blatant hypocrisy of many of today's intellectuals, who preach an open mind, tolerance, and all the rest of it, while carefully permitting nothing but variants of the same identical irrationalism, altruism, collectivism axis to be spread in their universities, symposia, debates, etc. But the Ford Hall Forum, Miss Rand always said, was different. It was honest. It was open to dissent and to new ideas, and therefore did represent a really intellectual organization, whether she agreed with the other speaker's ideas or not. For that reason, she appeared year after year, and as you know, her admirers came to look on it as a tradition. The New York Times recently described these annual gatherings as the Objectivist Easter. And I accept the term. And I have etymology on my side because the word Easter originally comes from Eos, the Greek goddess of the dawn, and means the festival celebrating the vernal equinox. In other words, symbolically, the rebirth of light and life after the darkness of winter. I want here sincerely and publicly to thank the Ford Hall Forum for making these Easter gatherings possible. And I want especially to thank its officers for the intellectual justice that they showed to Ayn Rand when she was alive. Now, the speech that I will be reading this evening was given originally last November before an audience of 3,000 businessmen in New Orleans at an investment seminar sponsored by the National Committee for Monetary Reform. Ms. Rand had intended to edit and expand the speech for tonight's audience, who are not predominantly businessmen. Unfortunately, she took ill before she could begin the job, and I have had to decide whether to do the editing myself or not. And I have decided not to do any editing at all, so that you may hear exactly as she herself wrote and delivered it, the last speech Ayn Rand gave. Now, this decision has, however, some drawbacks. For one thing, it means that I will be announcing as news the television series of Atlas Shrugged, which was news in New Orleans, but is now known, I'm sure, to all of you. I can, however, if you are interested, supply an update on that announcement in the question period. For another thing, my decision means that I must read aloud to you some brief praise of my own book. I hope you will forgive me for this. Finally, my decision means that you will have to bear with several sentences aimed directly at an audience of businessmen. Now, you can either ignore those references, or I suggest that for those moments you simply imagine that you are there in New Orleans, in the vast auditorium with the gigantic TV screen behind her, reproducing Miss Rand's every expression and gesture. Imagine that you are there listening in and watching the crowd's reaction, which I may say was hushed attentiveness, punctuated by spurts of excited applause or laughter, all of them dwarfed by a tumultuous ovation when the Atlas Shrugged TV announcement was made. All right, now I'm going to start with Ayn Rand's text, The Sanction of the Victims. Ladies and gentlemen, since the subject of these seminars is investment, I must start by stating that I am not an economist and have no purely economic advice to give you. But what I am anxious to discuss with you are the preconditions that make it possible for you to gain and to keep the money which you can then invest. I shall start by asking a question on a borrowed premise. What human occupation is the most useful socially? The borrowed premise is the concept of social usefulness. It is not part of my philosophy to evaluate things by a social standard. But this is the predominant standard of value today. And sometimes it can be very enlightening to adopt the enemy's standard. So let us borrow the notion of social concern for just a little while. Just long enough to answer the question, what human occupation is the most useful socially? Since man's basic tool of survival is his mind, the most crucially important occupation is the discovery of knowledge, i.e., the occupation of scientists. But scientists are not concerned with society, with social issues, or with other men. Scientists are essentially loners. They pursue knowledge for the sake of knowledge. A great many scientific and technological facts were known before the Industrial Revolution and did not affect human existence. The steam engine, for instance, was known in ancient Greece. But knowledge of that sort remained an exclusive concern that lived and died with scientists, and for century after century had no connection to the lives of the rest of mankind. Now suppose that a group of men decided to make it their job to bring the results of the achievements of science within the reach of men, to apply scientific knowledge to the improvement of man's life on Earth. Wouldn't such men be the greatest social benefactors, as they have been since the Industrial Revolution? Shouldn't the socially concerned humanitarians, those who hold social usefulness as their highest value, regard such men as heroes? If I say no, such men are not regarded as heroes today. They are the most hated, blamed, denounced men in the humanitarian society. Would you believe me? Or would you think that I'm inventing some sort of irrational fiction? And would you say that something is wrong, terribly wrong, in such a society? But this isn't all. There is something much worse. It isn't merely the fact that these heroic men are the victims of an unspeakable injustice. It is the fact that they are first to perpetrate that injustice against themselves. That they adopt a public stance of perpetual apology and universal appeasement, proclaiming themselves guilty of an unspecified evil, begging the forgiveness of every two-bit intellectual, every unskilled laborer, every unemployed politician. No, this is not fiction. That country is the United States of America today. That self-destroying group of men is you, the American businessman. When I say you, I mean the group as a whole. I accept the tenet that present company is accepted. However, if any of you find a shoe that fits, wear it with my compliments. Karl Marx predicted that capitalism would commit suicide. The American businessmen are carrying out that prediction. In destroying themselves, they are destroying capitalism, of which they are the symbol and product, and America, which is the greatest and freest example of capitalism mankind has ever reached. There is no outside power that can destroy such men and such a country. Only an inner power can do it, the power of morality. More specifically, the power of a contemptibly evil idea accepted as a moral principle, altruism. Remember that altruism does not mean kindness or consideration for other men. Altruism is a moral theory which preaches that man must sacrifice himself for others, that he must place the interest of others above his own, that he must live for the sake of others. Altruism is a monstrous notion. It is the morality of cannibals devouring one another. It is a theory of profound hatred for men, for reason, for achievement, for any form of human success or happiness on earth. Altruism is incompatible with capitalism and with businessmen. Businessmen are a cheerful, benevolent, optimistic, predominantly American phenomenon. The essence of their job is the constant struggle to improve human life, to satisfy human needs and desires, not to practice resignation, surrender, and worship of suffering. And here is the profound gulf between businessmen and altruism. Businessmen do not sacrifice themselves to others. If they did, they would be out of business in a few months or days. They profit, they grow rich, they are rewarded, as they should be. This is what the altruists, the collectivists, and other sundry humanitarians hate the businessmen for, that they pursue a personal goal and succeed at it. Do not fool yourself by thinking that altruists are motivated by compassion for the suffering. They are motivated by hatred for the successful. The evidence is all around us, but one small example sticks in my mind as extremely eloquent. In the early 1930s, an assistant of Jane Addams, the famous social worker, went on a visit to Soviet Russia and wrote a book about her experience. The sentence I remember is, "How wonderful it was to see everybody equally shabby." If you think you should try to appease the altruists, this is what you are appeasing. The great tragedy of capitalism and of America is the fact that most businessmen have accepted the morality of altruism and are trying to live up to it. which means that they are doomed before they start. Another contributory evil is the philosophical root of altruism, which is mysticism, the belief in the supernatural, which preaches contempt for matter, for wealth, well-being, or happiness on earth. The mystics are constantly crying appeals for your pity, your compassion, your help to the less fortunate, yet they are condemning you for all the qualities of character that make you able to help them. Evil theories have to rely on evil means in order to hold their victims. Altruism and collectivism cannot appeal to human virtues. They have to appeal to human weaknesses. And where there are not enough weaknesses, they have to manufacture them. It is in the nature of altruists and collectivists that the more they need a person or a group, the more they denounce their victims, induce guilt, and struggle never to let the victims discover their own importance and acquire self-esteem. The businessmen are needed most by the so-called humanitarians because the businessmen produce the sustenance the humanitarians are unable to produce. Doctors come next in the hierarchy of being needed, and observe the hostility, the denunciations, and the attempts to enslave the doctors in today's society. Most businessmen today have accepted the feeling of guilt induced in them by the altruists. They are accused of anything and everything. For instance, the ecologists denounce the businessmen's refusal to sacrifice themselves to the snail darter and the Furbish lousewort. But the businessmen's actual guilt is their treason against themselves, which is also their treason against their country. The statement that aroused such fury among the collectivists, "What's good for General Motors is good for the country," was true. And the reverse is also true. What's bad for industry is bad for the country. I am here to ask you a question on my own, not on borrowed premises. What are you doing to the advocates of capitalism, particularly the young? Appeasement is a betrayal, not only of one's own values, but of all those who share one's values. If, for whatever misguided reason, businessmen are indifferent to and ignorant of philosophy, particularly moral and political philosophy, it would be better if they kept silent rather than spreading the horrible advertisements that make us cringe with embarrassment. By us, I mean advocates of capitalism. Mobil Oil ran ads in the New York Times which stated the following. I quote from memory. "Of the expression free, private, responsible enterprise, we strike out free and private as non-essential." One of the big industries advertises on television that they are full of people working for people. And some other big company announces on television that its goal is ideas that help people. I do not know what the ghastly PR men who come up with these slogans wanted us to think, that the companies worked for free or that they traded with people rather than with animals. The worst of the bunch is some new group in Washington, D.C. called something like Committee for the American Way, which puts out a television commercial showing some ugly, commonplace people of all kinds, each proclaiming that he likes a different type of music. "I like rock and roll, and I like jazz, and I like Beethoven," etc. Ending on a voice declaring, "This is the American way, with every man entitled to have and express his own opinion." I, who come from Soviet Russia, can assure you that debates and differences of that kind were and are permitted in Soviet Russia. What about political or philosophical issues? Why didn't those upholders of the American way show people disagreeing about nuclear weapons, or about abortion, or about affirmative action? If that committee stands for the American way, there is no such way any longer. Observe also that in today's proliferation of pressure groups, the lowest sort of unskilled laborer is regarded as the public and presents claims to society in the name of the public interest and is encouraged to assert his right, in quotes, to a livelihood. But the businessmen, the intelligent, the creative, the successful men who make the laborer's livelihood possible have no rights and no legitimate interests, are not entitled to their livelihood, their profits, and are not part of the public. Every kind of ethnic group is enormously sensitive to any slight. If one made a derogatory remark about the Kurds of Iran, dozens of voices would leap to their defense. But no one speaks out for businessmen when they are attacked and insulted by everyone as a matter of routine. What causes this overwhelming injustice? The businessmen's own policies, their betrayal of their own values, their appeasement of enemies, their compromises, all of which add up to an air of moral cowardice. Add to it the fact that businessmen are creating and supporting their own destroyers. The sources and centers of today's philosophical corruption are the universities. Businessmen are both contemptuous of and superstitiously frightened by the subject of philosophy. There is a vicious circle involved here. Businessmen have good ground to despise philosophy as it is taught today, but it is taught that way because businessmen abandoned the intellect to the lowest rungs of the unemployables. All the conditions and ideas necessary to turn men into abjectly helpless serfs of dictatorship rule the institutes of today's higher education as a tight monopoly, with very few and rare exceptions. Hatred of reason and a worship of blind emotions. Hatred of success and a worship of self-sacrifice. These are the fundamental notions that dominate today's universities. These notions condition and paralyze the minds of the young. If you want to discover how a country's philosophy determines its history, I urge you to read The Ominous Parallels by Leonard Peikoff. To be published this coming spring by Stein and Day. This brilliant book presents the philosophical similarities between the state of America's culture today and the state of Germany's culture in the Weimar Republic in the years preceding the rise of Nazism. It is the businessmen's money that supports American universities, not merely in the form of taxes and government handouts, but much worse, in the form of voluntary private contributions, donations, endowments, etc. In preparation for this lecture, I tried to do some research on the nature and amounts of such contributions. I had to give it up. It is too complex and too vast a field for the efforts of one person. To untangle it now would require a major research project and probably years of work. All I can say is only that millions and millions and millions of dollars are being donated to universities by big business enterprises every year, and that the donors have no idea of what their money is being spent on or whom it is supporting. What is certain is only the fact that some of the worst anti-business, anti-capitalism propaganda has been financed by businessmen in such projects. Money is a great power, because in a free or even a semi-free society, it is a frozen form of productive energy. and therefore the spending of money is a grave responsibility. Contrary to the altruists and the advocates of the so-called academic freedom, it is a moral crime to give money to support ideas with which you disagree. It means ideas which you consider wrong, false, evil. It is a moral crime to give money to support your own destroyers. Yet that is what businessmen are doing with such reckless irresponsibility. On the faculties of most colleges and universities, the advocates of reason, individualism, and capitalism are a very small minority, often represented by a feeble specimen of window dressing. But the valiant minority of authentic fighters is struggling against overwhelming odds and growing very slowly. The hardships, the injustices, and the persecutions suffered by these young advocates of reason and capitalism are too terrible a story to be told briefly. These are the young people whom businessmen should support. Or, if businessmen are too ignorant of academic issues, they should leave academic matters alone. But to support irrationalists, nihilists, socialists, and communists, who form an impenetrable barrier against the young advocates of capitalism, denying them jobs, recognition, or a mere hearing, is an unforgivable outrage on the part of irresponsible businessmen who imagine that it is morally safe to give money to institutions of higher learning. The lasting influence of the universities is caused by the fact that most people question the truth or falsehood of philosophical ideas only in their youth. And whatever they learn in college marks them for life. If they are given intellectual poison, as they are today, they carry it into their professions, particularly in the humanities. Observe the lifeless grayness, the boring mediocrity of today's culture, the empty pretentiousness, and the mawkish sentimentality of today's stage, screen, and television writing. There are no serious dramas any longer, and such few as attempt to be serious are of a leftist collectivist persuasion. On this subject, I can speak from personal experience. For several years, a distinguished producer in Hollywood has been attempting to make a television miniseries or a movie of my novel, Atlas Shrugged. He was stopped on two counts. One, he could not find a writer able to write a romantic drama, even though there are many good writers in Hollywood. And two, he could not raise the money for his project. Allow me to say, even though I do not like to say it, that if there existed a novel of the same value and popularity as Atlas Shrugged, but written to glorify collectivism, which would be a contradiction in terms, it would have been produced on the screen long ago. But I do not believe in giving up. So in answer to many questions, I chose this occasion to make a very special announcement. I am writing a 9-hour teleplay for Atlas Shrugged. I intend to produce the miniseries myself. There is a strong possibility I will be looking for outside financing to produce the Atlas Shrugged series. In conclusion, let me touch briefly on another question often asked me. What do I think of President Reagan? The best answer to give would be, but I don't think of him. And the more I see, the less I think. I did not vote for him, nor for anyone else, and events seem to justify me. The appalling disgrace of his administration is his connection with the so-called moral majority and sundry other TV religionists, who are struggling, apparently with his approval, to take us back to the Middle Ages via the unconstitutional union of religion and politics. The threat to the future of capitalism is the fact that Reagan might fail so badly that he will become another ghost, like Herbert Hoover, to be invoked as an example of capitalism's failure for another 50 years. Observe Reagan's futile attempts to arouse the country by some sort of inspirational appeal. He is right in thinking that the country needs an inspirational element. But he will not find it in the God, family, tradition swamp. The greatest inspirational leadership this country could ever find rests in the hands of the most typically American group, the businessmen. But they could provide it only if they acquired philosophical self-defense and self-esteem. Here is what young Americans have to say about it. I quote from the May 15, 1980 issue of The Intellectual Activist, a newsletter published by Peter Schwartz. Quote, feminists threaten to publicize the names of psychologists who hold their convention in a state which has not yet endorsed the Equal Rights Amendment. Unionists protest political functions that serve lettuce not approved by Cesar Chavez. Yet businessmen are willing not simply to tolerate denunciations of free enterprise, but to financially sponsor them, unquote. And I quote from an article by M. Northrop Beekner, The Root of Terrorism, in the October 1981 issue of the Objectivist Forum, published by Harry Binswanger. Quote, imagine the effect if some prominent businessmen were to defend publicly their right to their own lives. Imagine the earth-shaking social reverberations if they were to assert their moral right to their own profits, not because those profits are necessary for economic progress or the elimination of poverty, which are purely collectivist justifications, but because a living being has the right to live and progress and do the best he can for his life for the time he has on this earth, unquote. I recommend both these publications very highly. You may write to The Intellectual Activist at 131 Fifth Avenue, New York, New York, 10003. And to The Objectivist Forum at Box 5311, New York, New York, 10150. As for me, I will close with a quotation which is probably familiar to you. And I will say that the battle for capitalism will be won when we find a president capable of saying it. The world you desired can be won. It exists, it is real, it is possible, it's yours. But to win it requires your total dedication and a total break with the world of your past, with the doctrine that man is a sacrificial animal who exists for the pleasure of others. Fight for the value of your person. Fight for the virtue of your pride. Fight for the essence of that which is man, for his sovereign rational mind. Fight with the radiant certainty and the absolute rectitude of knowing that yours is the morality of life, and that yours is the battle for any achievement, any value, any grandeur, any goodness, any joy that has ever existed on this earth. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Peacock, for being with us here today and for undertaking a very difficult task. In the great tradition of the forum, we now have a more difficult task for you, which is to meet your audience on a question-by-question basis. I'll attempt to repeat those questions briefly as we go around the room. And we'll start over here where there's a great body of people and then go through the center and over to my right-hand side. But before I take a question from the audience, since I'm likely to ask sporadically out in through here and not get to them, I wonder if I could break all the rules on this strange and unusual evening at the forum to ask you two questions myself. Would you give us the update on Atlas Shrugged? And would you say something about Miss Rand?
Sure. Well, I'll take them in the order that you gave them. Miss Rand was aware at a certain point in her illness that she would not be able to complete the script. She asked me to ensure that the script was completed and that the television miniseries was produced. And I said that I would do that, and we are already taking steps to do that. I can't give names right at this point because things are not yet in a completely official state of affairs since her will has not yet been probated, and therefore legally at this point everything is in abeyance, but that's only a matter of a month or so. I think I, on the basis of representations that have been made to me by people with highly established reputations in the financial and entertainment fields, I feel very safe in saying that there is no doubt that there is unlimited funds available for such a production. It remains simply to work out the final arrangements whereby the financial company that would be putting up the money would unite with the production company that is going to be actually bringing assigning a scriptwriter, seeing that the script is completed, casting and producing it. And of course I have to get into the act besides these two entities. Let me just state what my position is. I am not myself choosing a scriptwriter, casting. In that regard, I am not producing the miniseries. That is not my field. I know very little about that field. I wouldn't consider entering the movie business. So if you have sent or you know people who are sending letters, I'm the wrong one. So far, it's too soon if you want to play Dagny or whatever. But in any event, I'm not casting. Miss Rand made it very clear to me explicitly, I'm telling you this so you will know in advance exactly what I am and am not attempting to do, and you can judge the final production, which will be 2 to 3 years, I may say, before it finally gets from its present stage to actually to the screen. You can understand what I am trying to do. She told me, do not attempt to get the kind of control that I, Ayn Rand, got, because I'm a fiction writer and the author of this. And you are a professor, and this is not your field. You cannot ask for it. It's non-objective. Simply try to get somebody good and see that it is preserved philosophically intact. And that is what I'm restricting my mission to. I'm going to have, in effect, how will I put it, a veto power. So that if in the script or in the casting or whichever there is something which I would consider an offense, philosophically or whatever, against Miss Rand's views or spirit, I will reserve the contractual power to have that taken out. But other than that, that is the sole power that I am going to have in it. I know that the people that are involved in this sincerely want to do something of a high quality. They are not looking at it as simply a commercial enterprise in the low sense of the term commercial, but in the high sense. They're committed to the ideas. This does not mean that they would always do it the way that Ms. Rand would want it done. We can only do the best possible to us, and I think it's important in accordance with her wishes and for the sake of the culture to bring out what the best version that we can within the limits of the possible. She herself completed, Ms. Rand, 1/4 of the script. That, of course, will appear intact. The rest will have to be written. The only thing I can think of offhand to tell you further about that is that in deference to her tonsorial values, I'm going to require as a contractual stipulation that none of the heroes can be cast by people who have beards or mustaches, which she hated. That is about the story, and of course further details about the production and so on will be available in the Objectivist Forum, will be printed there in the announcement section as they become available. That pretty much catches you up on that. Now, the other was, I said I would say some words about Miss Rand's last weeks. It's a difficult subject, but I felt that those of you who came here tonight are largely, I assume, her fans and probably long-standing fans, and you felt something personal for her, and as of course I did. And in your position, I would be curious. So I don't want to be ghoulish, and I don't want to say too much, but I don't want to say nothing. So I'm going to try to take the golden mean. She was very ill from the end of January and was progressively sicker, weaker. She slept most of the time. She was lucid when she was awake. She was extremely weak. It was very difficult for her to speak or to form words at all. It was sometimes quite difficult to recognize the words because she didn't have the strength to articulate them fully. But she was completely lucid until the end. At times, I believe that she did know that it was the end. At other times, when she felt maybe stronger, perhaps she didn't know that clearly in those moments. But she did retain her resolution, her strength of character right to the end. I can tell you the last significant conversation I had with her was on the Thursday evening. I went to her. She was at home at that time. She was extremely weak. And the nurse got her up in a chair, and I said to her that the Bobbs Merrill press release was due. And I said, would you like me to handle it, or do you want to postpone the book for another 6 months? And she said, very feebly, but she said, neither. And I said, well, I couldn't even think what a third alternative would be. She said, I'll do it. So I wasn't sure she understood me, and I said, well, there's this two-page press release that they have to have approval of the copy on tonight, because I have to give it to them tomorrow. Well, she said, I'll do it. She took the type press release, and the nurse put her glasses on. She read, I guess, one paragraph or so, and fell asleep. So I took it from her. We sort of gently roused her. And I said, did you read it? She said, no, I didn't get through it. And I said, well, I'll read it aloud and tell me if it's okay. And I read it aloud, watching her to make sure that, you know, she still was awake through it. And she stayed awake throughout the whole thing. She listened right to the last word, and she said, that's okay. And I questioned her about one fact to make sure that she had got the full meaning, and she did get it completely correctly. That was the last business act, the last professional decision that she made. At what cost, I don't know how she could have been able to focus under those conditions, but she did. And if I tell you something very personal, it'll perhaps give you the last emotional encounter that I had with her. Was that same evening, because the next evening she was extremely tired, and I only spoke to her for just a few minutes on the Friday evening. So the last time I saw her at any length was the Thursday evening. I said to her, which was a solemn truth, this was not just a compliment to her, that I had been doing the page proofs of my book. I've been reading it sort of from morning to night, and that I was overwhelmed by the fact of how right she was philosophically, that my own book convinced me more than any single other thing of how right her philosophy was and why it was altruism that was destroying the world, and that I had never seen it so clearly, and that I wanted to thank her. I didn't realize this would be the last time I'd ever be able to say that to her. And she, I don't know how to describe it, she gave a huge smile. She kind of beamed, kind of a startled, surprised smile, which is the first smile I'd seen in weeks. And she fell asleep with a smile on her face. And we tiptoed out. And that's really the last I remember her that way. That's, I think I'll confine myself to that.
Thank you very much. We owe you a double debt. Now for what you've been able to share with us here tonight. Is there a question for Dr. Peikoff over in this area? We'll start here in the front. Yes, sir. Will there be a transcript of this talk at some point?
Yes, it's going to be reprinted in the next issue of the Objectivist Forum, which was Ms. Rand's practice.
Yes, sir.
For those of the businessmen that are supporting the university, the two, in my view, seem to be contradictory. My question is, how do you explain the contradiction?
Our questioner asks a contradiction about Ms. Rand's support for the Forum, which has a series of intellectually divergent views presented from this same lectern, versus remarks made in the body of the speech about businessmen supporting universities, where there are a diversity of views.
Well,
would you please explain that Ms. Rand has not been financing the Ford Hall Forum for 74 years?
Certainly. First of all, she has not been financing the Ford Hall Forum, but she would be very happy for businessmen to finance the Ford Hall Forum or to support it. And there's no contradiction at all between those two, precisely because the Ford Hall Forum does have a diversity of views, and the universities that she was talking about do not. A diversity of views in this context means a diversity on fundamentals. The Ford Hall Forum actually does have people who have different opinions. They have pro and con on such questions as reason and self-sacrifice and individual rights. This is not what most universities have, leaving aside token window dressing. They have a diversity of opinion in philosophy, for instance, between those who hold that we should go by reason, which has nothing to do with reality, or go by reality and ignore reason. Now, this is not a diversity of opinion. It's two variants of the same opinion coming from the same father, Immanuel Kant. There's a diversity of opinion in psychology between those who say man has no mind, he's just a behavioral series of reflexes, and those who say, yes, he does, but it's controlled by his unconscious seething inherited primeval drives, etc. The Freudians and the behaviorists. This is not a diversity of fundamental viewpoint. It's two anti-mind attitudes. So in this sense, it is not true that the universities in this country represent a diversity of viewpoint. They would love you to think that. The universities are largely closed to antagonistic viewpoints in this country. There's a monolithic intellectual establishment viewpoint which is upheld with the tenacity virtually of a dictatorship in this country. And it's precisely that Ayn Rand did not want to businessmen or anybody else to support. If you want to know what she thought should be done about it concretely, in her forthcoming book, Philosophy Who Needs It, there is a chapter called Fairness Doctrine for Education, in which she suggested a modest first step that could be taken to breaking up the university's ideological monopoly. But that's a different question.
Another question out here in the rear. Yes, sir, go ahead.
My question concerns what Dr. Peikoff is going to be doing in the future. For example, a compilation of objectivism, a book on that sort of thing. Can you say anything about that?
Your questioner is asking what your plans for the future are, and in fact you referred to them early in the speech by saying that you might be doing some work in objectivism.
Yes, I am going to, in a general way, I am aiming to go back to teaching at university, assuming I could find one. The difficulty there, of course, is not only the viewpoint, but that there are no positions in philosophy. There are 500 applicants for every opening. But assuming that there were any, that is my professional priority. In regard to objectivism, my first priority is to sell my book. I'm going on a nationwide tour throughout most of June and July, 15 cities to advertise this book. I'll probably then spend August in the hospital. But then I intend to start writing books myself and to give further courses. I will probably give another course, a new course on objectivism in the fall. I want to do a book on philosophy myself in the fall, probably on the mind-body question and its ramifications in all the different branches of philosophy. But subsequently, I'm going to do a systematic nonfiction presentation of the objectivist philosophy. And there are many other people that I know are going to be doing different kinds of writing on objectivism, and all of that will be announced in the Objectivist Forum, so you can keep track of it that way.
Another question on the aisle right here, ma'am.
I would like to know, as a counselor for education, high school graduates, where would you send today's youth to get a good, quote, very good education?
Do you have a recommendation of where one high school counselor might send a student to get a good college education?
Are you talking about a good undergraduate liberal arts education or a pre-professional education?
Why don't you give us both?
I don't have an answer for either, but I just thought I'd narrow it down. pre-professional, I don't think it's so difficult. There are recognized good schools in medicine and law and so on, so I'll confine myself to the undergraduate liberal arts education. There are no colleges where objectivists set the terms or run the departments. There are individual professors of philosophy at individual schools, a few. But you could not choose a school on that grounds. I would say, therefore, you have to decide. You could counsel your students on the basis partly of the subject that they want to major in, and partly on the nature of the school itself. For instance, take philosophy, with which I'm most familiar. I would choose a school that has a good program in the history of philosophy and that steers, that plays light with contemporary philosophy, as opposed to one which gives you one course on Thales to Dewey and then 17 courses on every incarnation of Wittgenstein and his associates. Take an undergraduate school which is heavy on Plato, Aristotle, Kant, who, right or wrong, at least dealt with the fundamental issues, and you'll get something from your education. And the same, I would say, is true in all the fields. If it's economics, try to take one which is heavy on the classical economists and so on. In other words, choose by the best of the available tradition. The other thing is this: why are you going to college today? You basically have to make a decision what the purpose is. I do not believe, aside from some good teachers or remnants of good tradition, that universities today are institutions of learning. I think they're really corrupt, and you have to go, therefore, for a realistic purpose. And this is perhaps cynical, but unfortunately, in my opinion, accurate. The realistic purpose is that the value of the degree. And from that point of view, an Ivy League school's degree has more worth. And consequently, if you can get into Columbia or Yale or Princeton, etc., other things being equal, I would certainly recommend that. Because your degree will be worth more to you in terms of employment, in terms of getting into graduate school, etc. I do not have any grounds to believe that the Ivy League is less fair than anything else in the country. If anything, they're as or more fair. And I know that in Columbia, for instance, is very fair in the sense that they don't penalize you for disagreement in philosophy. And I'm sure this is generally true. And consequently, I generally advocate go for a school which is regarded as high quality, because it's not any worse than the ones that are regarded as low quality. And you may as well get something. Now, that's the best I can do for you.
Here in the center, perhaps? Yes.
How can college students today convince other college students that politics and philosophy are more than just a game?
Ah, good question from someone who suffers through the practicalities of the job search in colleges. How can college students today convince other college students that politics and philosophy are something more than just an intellectual game?
You want to convince your fellow students that philosophy is not just a game. Well, I don't know a magic single argument that you could present that would convince them, because presumably it would be a philosophic argument and they would dismiss it as just a game that you're playing. So you would have to do it by asking them what is their reason for this view. If it's simply the impression that they formed from the classes that they've been to, you could say that it's a plausible impression, but you could suggest politely that perhaps their classes have not been entirely representative of the whole field of philosophy. You know, if they've taken philosophy 1 and discovered only Wittgenstein 2, this is not necessarily a broad academic survey. You have to tell them bluntly your view of philosophy. That, of course, depends what it is. I would tell them I regard philosophy as an extremely practical subject. It's in no way a game. It's essential to life. There's no options. The truth is completely objective. Say a few completely provocative things that they'll think as incredible, but at least cut through, you know, that you have established that you have something, some different viewpoint, and then if they're interested, defend it or recommend somebody that can. And in this connection, Ms. Rand's book, This Fall, Philosophy, Who Needs It, is very relevant. Her title essay there is The West Point Speech. And it's specifically addressed to college students to tell them why would anybody need a subject like this and why it isn't a game.
In the center, right here? Yes, sir.
Is there any possibility that all of Ayn Rand's talks given at this forum, I mean, I know that they've all been published here and there over the years, but is there any possibility that all of them could be republished all in one place in one book under one cover?
Questioner asks if there are any thoughts or plans of collecting all of Ms. Rand's speeches here at the forum under one cover. I know each was reprinted, was it not,
yes,
in her newsletter?
Yes, the problem with that idea would be contractual agreements, because so many of them are already parts of anthologies which have been contractually agreed to with various publishers who own those rights now. And whether they would agree, I don't know. Let me say, in general, I have been deluged with requests and suggestions for books about Ms. Rand, anthologies, etc. And without going into the details, there's certainly going to be a lot coming out. Whether that particular project will materialize, it certainly is an interesting idea, but I don't know how many conflicts there are and what the attitude of the publishers who presently hold the copyrights would be.
Yes.
Any suggestions as to what one might do to make that possible?
I think this question about how your book might become a bestseller is something that you may as well answer now and then in 15 cities in June and July.
Well, no, I won't tell this audience, I don't think, what my book is about, because that I think they know. But there's only one thing that makes a bestseller. A bestseller is is a very unique category. A bestseller is those books which sell at selected bookstores in this country. Mail order sales are not counted as part of a bestseller. And there are many, many books which far outsell the top bestsellers and are never heard of. They're not reviewed. They're not carried in bookstores. They have maybe 10, 20 times the sales of the big bestsellers, but they're completely underground because the bestseller list is exclusively compiled from a select number of bookstores. So if you're interested in specifically what you said, and you were going to purchase a copy of the book, I would certainly suggest that you look in the yellow pages of your city under some big chain like Dalton or Walden Books or Doubleday or Scribner's, etc. Not the corner grocer, but and I'll leave it for you to take it from there. Yeah.
Thank you. Yes.
Is there any valid place for a central bank such as the Federal Reserve System of the United States in a completely free society?
The question is, in a completely free society, is there any valid place for a central banking system such as the Federal Reserve System?
No. Can I elaborate? Just a very brief elaboration, the Federal Reserve System was a typical product of the progressive era. I believe it was 1913 that it began, and it is the government taking control of the banking system. And the consequence of that was, of course, of the Federal Reserve policies was the Depression of 29. If a government takes control of money and credit, which is what a central banking system would do, that means it has its hand on the literal lifeblood of the economy. And there's a short distance between that and complete socialism. There is no function for any such system. Even, you can make a very good case that even the coinage of money should not be a governmental function. And as a matter of fact, I think one way that it probably would work would be simply by large banks having coins or even certificates backed by coins, and those would begin to circulate as money backed by the bank, and it would be a contractual matter. So I would say in a completely free society, to be consistent, there should be complete separation of state and money. The only role of there would be voluntary contributions to the government, but that's a different thing.
In red, right here.
What's the procedure for bringing one of the taped lecture courses to your city?
What is the procedure for bringing a taped lecture course to your city?
I did not plant that question either.
So far, you're doing very well.
We have now got one all-purpose address, and I'm happy to have this opportunity to give it to you. If there's ever anything you want to know about objectivism, about the publications that carry its message, the schools, the courses, the Foundation for the New Intellectual, etc., we've got one all-purpose address. You just have to write to Objectivism, Box 177, Murray Hill Station, New York City. You don't even need a zip code if you say that. Box 177, Murray Hill Station, New York City. This is now completely automatic. It's touched by human hands, but only barely. So you will undoubtedly not receive a personal reply, but you will get on all the mailing lists that will, in due course, let you know everything there is to be found out about my courses and everything else.
In white, yeah.
Can you tell us anything about the unpublished work of Ayn Rand and why they weren't unpublished and whether they would be?
Could you tell us anything about the unpublished work of Ayn Rand and why it might have been unpublished and will it be published?
Well, I'm in a difficult position because I am not actually legally entitled to discuss that question at this time because the will not having been probated. So I can just speak in very, very vague generalities. There were a lot of things that Ms. Rand wrote on different subjects that she did not consider appropriate to publish at her lifetime, which would be of interest to her fans. And this material has to be gone through. Some of it pertains to fiction, some to nonfiction. And this material will be gone through, and whatever material I think that she would have not objected to having been made public with the appropriate introduction and so on, we will certainly make public in book form at some point. But I'm actually restrained by law from going any further.
That sounds like a question, yeah, perhaps for Murray Hill Station at some point.
Right, right.
Yes, sir.
I'm most interested in the character of Hayes, but what do you think of what is going on right now with the Argentines and the British?
The question really is, what do you think is going on right now with the Argentines and the British? It refers to a long tradition here at the forum of asking current events questions of our speakers, and the questioner is also particularly interested in the character of Mr. Haig in those negotiations.
I have more opinions on the character of Mr. Haig. I very much am against the Secretary of State. I think that he is essentially Henry Kissinger the second, with only a shift in his rhetoric to the right, but not in the reality of his actions. He is an out-and-out Republican moderate type, with all the appeasement in actual practice that implies, but he periodically makes a conservative or right-wing or anti-Russian statement, sometimes quite intelligent and strong statements, which then have no relationship to his behavior. So it's like Henry Kissinger with an act to appease Ronald Reagan's supporters. I think that's offensive. And as far as his general conduct of foreign policy, I think he has the best analyses of Haig appear regularly in the New York Times by William Safire, who reveals what Haig is actually doing. And if you're interested in that, I get most of my information about Haig's two character from William Safire. But he has caved in, or has urged cave-ins, on every kind of sensitive foreign question, from the Polish, rolling over the Polish debt. And the latest thing that Safire reported was that The question came up in Congress as to whether to reaffirm whether the Congress should reaffirm the 1961 or whatever Kennedy ultimatum to the Russians not to introduce missiles in Cuba. And because of their own devious purposes of courting Cuba at that point, the Reagan administration, with Haig, urged Congress not to offend Cuba by reaffirming such a controversial thing as that there should not be missiles placed on, Russian missiles placed on Cuban soil and aimed at the United States. Now, those are just two out of many other examples, and from that point of view, I'm very opposed to the whole policy. It seems to me, although I have not followed the Falklands Island dispute, I was in Bermuda when it happens, and there's very little news in Bermuda when it first happened, and I feel like a soap opera, of which I missed the whole first chapter. But from what I can tell, this was from what I can tell, I have to say, I'm not an expert in this field, and philosophy does not have a foreign policy. But from what I can tell, this was a naked act of aggression by Argentina without any warrant of any kind. And the British reacted properly. I wish they had had a fleet that could get there in the same century in which the act... of aggression had taken place, but better late than never. And I certainly do not approve of the idea of a mediator running between the perpetrator and the victim, trying to get each to compromise to some extent. However, if you ask me what would I do if I was Secretary of Haig, given everything, I would resign. I won't go further than that.
In the rear here, in the section. All right, one more over here on the aisle. Yes.
With public education, I'm very concerned, having children this age, how do you kind of penetrate the quagmire that exists now in that they don't really teach very much?
How do you penetrate the quagmire of public education in this day and age?
Well, you say without going to private education. Well, even private education wouldn't help you that much because all education on the early levels are heavily influenced by Dewey or by his derivatives. And the alternative, of course, the schools which have better standards are usually very religious. That's the base from which they get their better standards. So the only way you can really penetrate it is the only way that you can penetrate all the institutions which are degenerating today, and that is philosophically. That's why Ayn Rand always said it was too early for politics. What we need is a philosophic education, and that has to start not with the grade schools, but with the professors. First, you've got to get professors. You have to get intellectuals teaching at universities. And then they're the ones that teach the teachers who then go out to the grade schools, the junior high schools, and so on, and introduce better programs. Now, the only other thing I would add is, you may know Mr. Andrews is a great admirer of the Montessori schools, and the more you can do to promote the Montessori, if it's the authentic Montessori and not just the name used as a cover-up for something modern, that's one thing you could do. But more broadly, there's no formula except you have to change what's taught in philosophy departments, which is murder to do because you can't get into philosophy departments. So.
Is there a question on this side of the year? Yes, ma'am.
Can you tell me if there's any one politician today that Ms. Rand consistently agrees with and applauds?
Can you tell us if there is a politician currently active with whom Ms. Rand continually agreed?
The only one I could think of, and I'm sure he would kill me for calling him a politician, is Alan Greenspan.
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
I read on the evening of the Ethics Forum that Ms. Rand was considered a matter of honor to leave one's life in order. And I wondered if she considered it a dishonor to leave one's life in somewhat of a disarray.
Our questioner asks a couple of questions. First, is it dishonor to leave one's life in disorder? Secondly, how did you meet and become her associate?
She would not say it was a dishonor to leave your life in disorder. if you left this life suddenly without foreknowledge. If you were young and in good health and run over by a truck and die intestate, that's not a moral deficiency. But if you have a property of any degree and you have reason to recognize your mortality, your age, your health, or whichever, and you deliberately do not make provision, she would certainly consider that improper. I know, for instance, that she was very contemptuous of Howard Hughes for having had that gigantic estate and being so irresponsible as to leave either none or 10 wills, depending upon who you listen to, and have that thing litigated, you know, all over the world. And she was absolutely emphatic that that was not going to happen to her, which it didn't. So in that sense, if it's that kind of, leaving your life in chaos, she was completely opposed to it. As to what was it, how I met her, I was introduced through a mutual friend. I was 17. I was an admirer of the Fountainhead. I had just finished my freshman year. She lived in California at the time. And I got a chance to meet her for an evening, and I asked her a whole bunch of philosophic questions about the Fountainhead. And she liked some of the questions. And subsequently, she moved to New York, I was in pre-med at the time, but I was quickly converted to philosophy because she convinced me that there were answers to philosophic questions. The thing that overwhelmed me, I had been asking philosophic questions for many years, and everyone thought this was ridiculous. You couldn't, everyone in the town that I grew up. She took them enormously seriously. She was very intent, and I was just a completely ignorant kid. But she would give a full-fledged answer to my groping question, and then after she gave the answer, which dazzled me, she would explain what confusion on my part had led to my formulating the question the way I did, and then she would say, and now tomorrow or next week when you're thinking over my answer, this is what's going to occur to you, and the answer to this is after, a couple of evenings of that, this was to me irresistible. And I found out about a year later that people were actually paid money to discuss things like that. You know, that was what philosophy was, and I promptly gave up medicine. And moved to New York, and subsequently read Atlas Shrugged in manuscript with several other people in the early 50s. And then thereafter began to teach her ideas and write and so on.
Who here?
I think often hoping that you will be invited to Fort Hall Forum next year and for many years thereafter.
In answer to that, the officials of Fort Hall Forum said to me before it started this evening that they very much want to continue this springtime tradition, and I said I was very happy to, so let's do it.
I think that's really a very, very good place to end, and I want to add to that my sense that there have been few speakers here at the forum who have, in fact, been probed not only on their issues and their ideologies, but probed separately and as deeply personally as you have been in this particular very special evening, and we thank you very much for being here with us.
Leonard Peikoff, substituting for the late Ayn Rand, has addressed the Ford Hall Forum. He delivered a speech that Ms. Rand wrote before her death this winter. The moderator was Dee Crossell. This program was recorded on April 25, 1982, for broadcast at this time. Next week's forum features author Maya Angelou. She will receive the Ford Hall Forum's First Amendment Award. From Northeastern University in Boston, this is Becky Rohr with engineer Francis I. Leggetti. The Ford Hall Forum is produced by WGBH Boston for National Public Radio.